This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a real pleasure to welcome to the program a good friend of mine, Lori Kelling, who along with her husband Mel owns and operates Tannenbaum Farms just outside of Mason, Michigan. And as the name suggests, Tannenbaum specializes in Christmas trees and associated fun. Lori, 'tis the season.
It is. We are so glad to be with you this morning.
Well, you just opened.
Yes, we did. And it's always exciting to gear up for the Christmas season. We've had lots of people that have been waiting for this day to happen.
Well, I know this, and I know my producer knows it better than I do because he's one of your regular customers out there. But how many people come through Tannenbaum Farms on a typical holiday season?
Well, we expect about 20,000 people, plus or minus, but that's a lot of people that visit the farm.
So a little history. You and Mel have been at this for a long time, and it's been quite a success story. But you started rather humbly, and it's grown into something rather magnificent.
Exactly. My husband has been a professor of forestry at Michigan State University, and it was an extension of his work to practice what he preached. So he started the farm in about 1969, and so this has been an absolute transgression of this business, starting to plant trees so the kids would have a college education fund, and it has certainly grown into a full-time business.
Yeah, I think you started with about maybe just a little over 3 acres, and now you're at what?
At this point, we're at 180 acres. We just added another 20 acres.
And how many trees do you plant each year?
We plant between 6 and 10,000 trees a year to keep the trees in a constant rotation. We plant a 10-year rotation, so we need to keep those trees growing. And the years that we have drought and other problems or possibly too much rain and they drowned, it gets to be a challenge to keep a constant supply growing for the public.
Well, how long does it take to grow a tree to maturity so that when folks go out there, they can cut that tree down and take it home?
We can start cutting them at about 8 years of age, and then to maybe 10 years is our annual expected rotation. But sometimes for those people who want that 10-foot to 18-foot tree, those trees are growing up to 20 years before they're of the size that they want.
You know, I might mention this, and you and I know this, but folks that may not have a background in the German language, but Tannenbaum is the German word for
Christmas tree.
Right, so that's where that word comes from, for those who may not be familiar with the Deutsch. But what other experiences, besides actually selecting and cutting a tree, can folks have? I know you've got a lot of other attractions at Tannenbaum.
We do. People can just come to the farm and not cut your own tree. We do have a large selection of high-quality trees. So for those people who are beyond the age of wanting to take their children out in the field, they can get a tree at that point. Otherwise, we welcome you. You get on a wagon ride drawn by a tractor. We take you out to our cabin. There's a bonfire. You can get a hot dog, a nice hot chocolate, hot cider. From there, you pick up a little cart and a saw, and we direct you into the different areas where we're cutting our trees.
Well, now, I've got a 2-year-old granddaughter. Is she at the age yet where she could enjoy all that sort of thing?
I think she would love it. We have a reindeer. His name is Ole, so you can pet him at the cabin and take your pictures. He's usually pretty friendly, and you can nuzzle with him and take as much time as you want on the farm.
Well, Lori, when folks do come out, whether they're cutting their own or selecting one that's been pre-cut, what are some things people need to be thinking about when they select a tree?
Well, these trees look very small out on the farm, so I would suggest that you raise your arm or bring a measuring stick or something to give you an idea of what the height really is. I do pre-tag the trees and price them, and occasionally I put a height on them so you get an idea of how tall that tree is, but I think that's the biggest surprise for people is that tree is so much larger when you get home than you expected it to be.
And there's nothing worse than having to get it into the house, and you know nobody wants to cut any of that beautiful tree in order to make it fit into a living room. So that sounds like some really good advice.
It is.
What about when they get the tree home? They need to water it right away?
You want to make sure you get that tree in water immediately. It forms a seal on the base of the tree, and you don't want that to harden off. Otherwise, you'd have to make another fresh cut on it. So we just suggest water. Do not put anything else in that water. We haven't shown that any of these preservatives help it. Some people have suggested sugar. All that does is induce mold growth in the tree stand, and you don't want that to happen.
No. My guest is Lori Kelling. She's the co-owner of Tannenbaum Farms just outside of Mason, Michigan. We're talking Christmas trees. So all these supplements that you see advertised to put in the water or add sugar or all of these home remedies for taking care of trees, forget all that. Just use water.
That is correct.
Just and whether you've got hard water or what, regardless of what kind of water, just water.
Just water. Just make sure that tree stand does not run low on water. Check it twice a day. I know that's a little bit of a job, but it's well worth it to have a nice fresh tree in your home.
And then what about down the trail after the holidays are over? Is there a good way to dispose of your Christmas trees?
Well, many communities do have chipping programs, and taking them back to parks, et cetera, to have them chipped is a great idea. I also know that many people put them in ponds for fish habitat, that type of thing. Other people put them in your yard and put maybe bird seed or feed on it and enjoy it for another several months.
Yeah, because it becomes a habitat for the birds.
Yes, it does.
That's kind of what we do, but we also, and I know there are some that pick it up and chip Christmas trees and use it for a trail cover. So yes. There are all sorts of uses of for these Christmas trees.
It is a nice natural product, and we enjoy providing them to our customers.
Well, speaking of natural products and always on this buy local sort of thing that you and I are both very supportive of, but the importance of the Christmas tree industry to Michigan's economy, a lot of folks may not be aware of it, and I know you are.
Yes, I'm the past executive director of the Michigan Christmas Tree Association, and Michigan really did put the Christmas tree industry on the map. I believe we are still number four in the nation in Christmas tree production, producing between 3 and 4 million trees annually.
Wow. Well, where's that put Michigan then, nationally?
Yes, that's nationally.
And then nationally.
Fourth.
Mm-hmm. Fourth nationally. And from again, probably rather humble beginnings.
Yes, very much so. My dad was an ag agent up in the thumb and helped get a lot of Christmas tree farms started.
Well, Lori, if people want more information on Tannenbaum Farms, you've got an excellent website. I've been on that website, but where can folks go?
Yes, www.tannenbaumfarm.com.
Now, back to some of the things that we can do at Tannenbaum Farms that will bring the whole family, that sort of a thing. What about your gift shop?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. We do have a lot of fun preparing the gift shop, and I make a couple thousand wreaths starting in the beginning of November, and we were really excited that Santa decided to join us on weekends last year. So now for 3 weekends, we do have Santa visiting, so if you come to the website, you can check those times, but that adds to the whole family experience at Tannenbaum Farms. But I have lots of trees and ornaments and wreaths, and you can sit by the fire and enjoy a hot cookie and cider also in the gift shop after you've picked out that perfect tree.
We've got a couple of minutes here left, but what are you finding in terms of preference of trees? Has that changed over time? Are people looking at a different kind of tree over the last 3 or 4 years, or are people still pretty traditional?
Kurt, that's really interesting because Michigan started with, the original balsam fir, and then we brought in the Scotch pine, which is not native to Michigan, and that's what put Michigan on the map as far as Christmas tree production. We learned how to trim those trees, how to cultivate them. They held well. We were able to ship them nationally. And then a nice little tree out of North Carolina became popular, and that's called the Fraser fir. And that certainly is a buzzword at Christmas time because everyone wants to see what this Fraser fir looks like. And once they have one, that is the tree of choice. So they're more difficult for us to grow here. They're obviously not native. If they have too much water or too much drought, they're going to die even as a mature tree. And they're a challenge, too, because they have cones that they produce, and we can spend up to 15 minutes per tree taking the cones off of those trees. So it's an added cost for us to produce that tree, but the public really loves it. They hold needles well. They're really hard to get them to shed, and they're soft to touch, easy to decorate, and just become a favorite.
I can offer a personal testimonial. For the last probably 5 or 6 years, we've had one Fraser fir, and then we do one Scotch pine, so we do one more traditional and the Fraser, but that Fraser fir is a beautiful tree.
It is. There's another one that is now becoming popular, which is the concolor fir, or a white fir, slightly longer needle, and that thing smells so good in your house. Very, very fragrant. So.
And we can, and you have all of those at Tannenbaum Farms.
We do.
I've been talking with Lori Kelling, who along with her husband Mel own and operates Tannenbaum Farms just outside of Mason. Website is, well, just Google Tannenbaum Farms. That's the easiest way to get there. But you do have a website, and it is?
www.tannenbaumfarm.com.
Lori, thanks so much for being on the program.
It's been a pleasure, and Merry Christmas.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, one topic that we traditionally cover on the show this time of the year is food safety during the holiday season. And this year we welcome no less, and who better than, an international recognized authority on listeria and other disease-causing bacteria in food. He is Dr. Elliot Reiser. He's a professor in the MSU Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition, and whose work is funded in part by our good friends at MSU Ag Bioresearch. Elliot, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Before we get into what some of the specific things people can do around their kitchens to ensure food safety during the holidays, a little bit about your work in listeria and foodborne pathogens in general. Some of these bad bacteria, how do they get into food?
Organisms like listeria are very widespread in the environment, so they're common in many different food products, also in food processing environments. So cross-contamination is a major issue. And listeria comes in as a contaminant after the product has been cooked.
Can it come into the food chain before then?
Yes, it can enter the raw product, but again, most cooking processes are able to eliminate the organism. One issue we've had and that we've seen is that the incidence of listeria is 7 times higher in delicatessen meat that's sliced at the delicatessen as opposed to that coming from the manufacturer. So again, that points to cross-contamination from the delicatessen slicer.
So that cross-contamination, I mean, let's boil that down. That can come from knives or cutting boards,
sure,
or what have you?
Knives, cutting boards, the deli slicer is a major source of contamination. These are very difficult to clean oftentimes, the commercial slicers.
The American food supply in general is pretty safe, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Right. We're doing a good job overall.
And and what about the incidence of things like salmonella and E. coli and listeria? I mean, has that reduced historically over time, or is it sort of... Or is it moving up in some areas, or is it a mixed bag?
Mixed bag. Salmonella has remained relatively constant. Listeria has decreased somewhat, and E. coli as well. But they're still very much on the radar screen in terms of major foodborne problems.
What are some ways when things like celery or well, just fruits and vegetables in general or meat products during the manufacturing process, what are some ways that manufacturers ensure that those pathogens are not in the food?
Well, there's no real way of ensuring that pathogens are not present in fresh fruits and vegetables, unfortunately. These products are washed in different types of sanitizers. Normally, they'll use a chlorine sanitizer, but if you have a lot of food particulates in the water, that will inactivate the chlorine and make it far less effective. So we're still seeing recalls of fresh-cut fruits and vegetables. This is an ongoing concern and probably the biggest issue facing the safety of the U.S. Food supply at present.
So it sounds to me like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's really a case of continual monitoring, testing of these foods as they go through the food chain.
Yes, that's true.
And so you mentioned chlorine. What about irradiation? You hear that there are some other sort of high-tech ways of reducing bacteria in foods.
Sure. We've done some work with X-ray irradiation here at Michigan State as well. We found it very successful. The process was developed by a company in Ann Arbor, Rayfresh, but it is not yet commercially available.
Now, one thing, and I must congratulate you, you were recently recognized as a distinguished faculty member from the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, but a lot of your work is very practical and applied. A lot of your research, I mean, you're actually working with food processors continuously across an array of foods to ensure, or to help them to ensure that the food that they're manufacturing is more safe than it might be otherwise.
True. Most of my work is very applied. I like to keep the food in food microbiology. So I work with a lot of products that are inoculated, and we look at ways of cross-contamination. We have a leafy green processing line in our department that we've been working with for the last 6 years, looking at cross-contamination of lettuce with E. coli during processing.
My guest is Dr. Elliot Reiser. He's a professor in the MSU Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition, whose work is supported in part by MSU Ag Bioresearch. What can people do in their kitchens once they bring the food home and they're ready to prepare those scrumptious holiday meals?
Okay, well, if we're talking turkey, that's probably one of the biggest culprits.
We're talking turkey. Okay, let's talk turkey.
So the turkey should be thawed in the refrigerator, not on the countertop. And you need to remember that turkey is a good source for salmonella, and also another very common cause of foodborne illness caused by Campylobacter. This is another bacteria. Mm-hmm. So these two are very prevalent. Incidence for salmonella in turkey may be 20%, and for Campylobacter maybe as high as 50%. Mm. So just assume that the product is contaminated.
Okay.
And therefore, you do not want to wash the carcass in the sink. This will only spread salmonella around to your countertop and other food contact areas in the kitchen.
So you thaw it in the refrigerator instead of on the counter, and so it's thawed. So then what do you do?
The turkey should not be stuffed if it's large. Small turkeys can be stuffed. If it's under, say, 14 pounds, then it's not an issue. But if the turkey is stuffed, the stuffing will not be thoroughly cooked. And there's also problems with the cooking of the turkey as well when you have the stuffing inside the carcass.
So that would come as a surprise to a lot of folks, because people typically stuff turkeys, whether they're small or large. But anything under 14 pounds, typically okay. Anything over, don't stuff it.
Right.
Cook that stuffing separately.
True.
Okay, so you've got the turkey in the oven, you're cooking it, and you obviously want to follow all of the instructions as it relates to cooking, right? I mean, that's probably hugely important.
Right. You want to cook the turkey until the breast meat is 170 and the dark meat is 180, and you should use a thermometer as well, obviously.
Yeah, and I know that thermometer thing. A lot of people do use thermometers, but what about the thermometers that actually come in a turkey, those that are actually inserted in the turkey when you buy them? That pop up when, are those reliable?
I would also use a regular thermometer along with the pop-up.
What about preparing some of those other foods? I mean, for, you're talking about, you know, you mentioned leafy green vegetables earlier, but your vegetables, your salads, your fruits, what have you, what are some precautions you need to take?
Well, again, if you're preparing the turkey in the kitchen, this can lead to more concerns with cross-contamination from cutting boards and counter surfaces. So you need to be very careful after you've got the turkey in the oven that you clean up the countertop, cutting boards, knives, etc., if you're going to start preparing fresh fruits and vegetables that will not be cooked.
And to what extent do you need to clean them? I mean, is this hot soapy water with the knives and the cutting boards and
sure.
what have you?
Sure, hot soapy water. And ideally, you should use different cutting boards for meat products and fruits and vegetables. So don't use the same cutting board for the turkey that you use to chop up the lettuce or the celery or
yeah,
onions,
I imagine
anything
most
else for that matter.
Would not occur to most people to use a different cutting board for different things. What about when the meal is over and you're you want to put those leftovers away and you want to keep them, obviously, from becoming cross-contaminated? What are some things you need to think about?
Well, the turkey should go back in the refrigerator within 2 hours of it sitting out. And also, any other heated food products should be refrigerated. But if you're preparing large quantities of product, say you have 5 pounds of mashed potatoes or 10 pounds, then cooling becomes an issue. You need to divide that into smaller portions, have it no deeper than about 3 inches in a flat pan in order for that product to be properly refrigerated in an acceptable length of time. Within 2 hours, you need to make up your mind if you're going to freeze it or refrigerate it.
Any other things that people might not think about that when either they're preparing or they're saving some of these foods?
Just keep in mind cross-contamination. The kitchen sponge has been notorious as a reservoir for bacteria. It's like a microbiological zoo. So they're now telling people to sanitize their sponges, and you can actually put the sponge in the microwave oven. But keep an eye on it to be sure it doesn't burn up.
I've been talking with Dr. Elliot Reiser. He's a professor in the MSU Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition. And Elliot, thanks so much for coming on Greening the Great Lakes, and thanks for all those great tips, and happy holidays
great.
To you.
Thanks much. You too.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
The University Research Corridor, Empowering Michigan.
This is an association of the three research universities in Michigan to really collaborate on a deeper level than we have in the past and highlight for ourselves and for the region and for the nation the strength in technology, innovation, new research, investment that we think is going to help change the Michigan economy.
That's University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman.
The mission of the URC is no less than to help transform the Michigan economy and to make this a vibrant place that young people will want to come and stay, that businesses will want to be in, because we are a place where a lot is happening, and we have the brain power for the new economy. It's here. It's in Michigan. We just need to tap it.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
So Michigan is vibrant. Michigan has all these things, and we want to signal that to the entire world.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, in town recently to meet with members of the Michigan Wheat Program Board, we caught up with Judy Adams. Judy is president of the Wheat Foods Council. She's also a registered dietitian and a national dietary and food grains expert. Judy, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, and it's fun to be in Michigan.
Well, let's start out. Explain to our listeners who may not be familiar with it, but the work of the Wheat Foods Council.
The Wheat Foods Council has been around for 41 years, believe it or not. We're primarily a grower organization. 80% of our money comes from growers, but the other 20% from the whole industry. So we are an industry organization.
And some of your members in Michigan, I think one comes to mind, the Kellogg Foundation or the Kellogg Corporation down in Battle Creek.
Absolutely. They've been a member of the Wheat Foods Council for years. In fact, I'm going to see them tomorrow, but we're very glad to have them on board.
Well, tell us now, okay, so what are some of the things that you do? Educational outreach, programs that tout wheat, I'm sure, wheat products, but what are some specific things that you do?
We just do nutrition education. We do not get into the production areas or anything else about wheat except nutrition education. And our focus this last year and this year have primarily been on supermarket dietitians because they go directly to the consumer. We can't afford to go directly to the consumer in this country. And so they take our messages. We develop kits. We develop speaking programs for them. We have an expert who is a PhD in nutrition, also a past president of the American Association of Cereal Chemists, so she knows the whole wide range of grains as well as nutrition. She does programs on gut health. Now, gut health is not exactly, you know, your cocktail conversation, and people aren't really excited about it, but she makes it exciting, and wheat is such a big part of good, beneficial gut health.
Now, most Americans have been eating wheat. I mean, I grew up with wheat in my family for a long time, so Americans really don't have to be convinced about the nutritional value of grains. But what are some of the things that wheat brings to the nutritional table?
Well, and I think it's interesting that you would say that, because around the turn of the last century, we were eating over 200 pounds of wheat flour per day, or per year, per person. And then it went down in the 1970s, and then it's come back to a 50-year high in 1997. Since 1997, wheat consumption has gone down again, and it's at the same time that obesity has gone up, which I think is really interesting because sometimes people want to blame wheat and carbohydrates for obesity, and that's obviously not the case. But one of the things we do promote both whole grains and enriched grains. Enriched grains we really promote for the folic acid content for women of childbearing age. I don't know if you're familiar with spina bifida and neural tube birth defects, but women need folic acid before they get pregnant, So they need it to have it in their food supply. And enriched grains do provide about 72% of the folic acid in the American diet. Now, whole grains are so easy to talk to people about how healthy they are because they're high in antioxidants, they're high in fiber, they're a good source of iron in the diet, they're a good source of vitamin E in the diet. So whole grains, they're also good for gut health, which, again, is becoming interesting to Americans but hasn't been until the last couple of years.
Now, you mentioned earlier that gut health is not your typical cocktail conversation, but for our listeners, explain what you mean when you use the term gut health.
Okay. Our guts, well, our entire body contains microbiomes, but the microbiomes, like the bacteria that we have in our gut, are very influential over our body and the health of our bodies. And it's really interesting. This is a really emerging science, and there's a lot we don't know about it. But we do think there's a relationship to obesity. All autoimmune diseases, including celiac disease, is increasing. And a lot of it's pointing to our gut health. We are taking more antibiotics. We're taking more antacids. Children are being less likely to be breastfed than they used to be, so they're not getting the mother's antibodies. There's a third of the children in this country are born through cesarean nowadays, which that was shocking to me. I had no idea. And they're not getting the bacteria through the birth canal. So there's a lot of things that are changing the gut health of Americans compared to what they were 50 years ago.
My guest is Judy Adams, and she's the president of the Wheat Foods Council. Why the growth of gluten-free foods in America in recent years?
Okay, a lot of the decrease came around, well, we were at high at 1997, and that's kind of when the low-carb diet started. So we did lose consumption then. The gluten, believe it or not, gluten-free has not hurt us yet. Last year, in fact, we actually increased 2 pounds per person per year, which was a surprise to me, and I'm just wondering how that happened. It may be because people aren't doing what they say, which would be a big surprise to all of us, or it might be because the numbers are wrong and it's going to catch up with us this year. We don't know. But the gluten-free started about 4 years ago, and it started because celebrities were using it for a diet to lose weight. And as a dietitian, I know that gluten-free does not make you lose weight. Now, if you cut out all wheat, rye, and barley, which are the three grains that have gluten, if you cut them out of your diet, you're cutting out a huge percentage of the biggest food group. So, yes, if you don't replace it with any other calories, you're going to lose weight. But you're also going to lose B vitamins, iron, fiber, antioxidants. You're not doing yourself any good unless you have celiac disease.
And for our listeners who may not know, and correct me if I'm wrong again, but gluten is actually a protein in wheat and barley that actually helps to make bread rise when you cook it, among other things.
Absolutely. If you've ever tried to make bread out of anything besides wheat, you don't get the nice volume and texture that you do. So, yes, gluten is a protein. I think if you had asked most Americans what is gluten, they would not know. And people that are taking gluten-free products in replacement are often substituting fat and calories and sugar for protein, which doesn't make sense to me. But it is a fad, and, you know, Americans are always looking for that magic bullet, that quick cure for whatever ails them. Now, there is the percentage of Americans that need to go gluten-free. It's less than 1%. In fact, it's actually 0.71%. One out of 141 Americans actually have celiac disease. Now, there's this other group that is very hard to determine how many people are in that. It's called non-celiac gluten sensitivity. And I see estimates anywhere from 1 to 10%. 6% is the only one that I've actually seen any data on, and that was not a random audience, so that's we're not sure about that number. But those are people who don't have celiac disease that seem to react to gluten, and it makes their lives easier if they don't eat it. But they need to make sure that they are substituting for whole grain products.
And put on your dietitian and nutritionist hat here, though, Judy. What would you recommend typically for a family of consumption of wheat and whole grains as part of the diet?
Well, I always use the dietary guidelines for Americans because they're reviewed every 5 years and by some of the greatest scientists in the United States, and their recommendations are for the average adult, they need 6 servings a day, and half of those should be from whole grains. So we are eating less than 1 whole grain a day right now. The thing that irritates me as a dietitian is that Americans have been getting great consumer advice for years. They don't follow it. Somewhere around 5% of Americans actually follow the dietary guidelines for Americans. Now, if a lot more followed it, we'd have a lot less diabetes. We'd have a lot less obesity. We'd have a lot less problems, but they're not following it. They're looking for these magic cures, so they go on and off diets that don't work long term and aren't sustainable. But yeah, and that means you're going to have to start eating a lot more fruits and vegetables. You're going to have to start eating more whole grains and a lot less, high-fat, high-sugar products.
I've been talking with Judy Adams. Judy is the president of the Wheat Foods Council. She was recently in Michigan to talk to the Michigan Wheat Program Board. Judy, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
MLive Media Group is a Greening of the Great Lakes partner. To read Kirk's blog and to hear our show archives, please visit mlive.com/environment.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, sometimes in the midst of all the Black Friday hype and commercialization around the holidays, we tend to forget that too many people in our communities are worrying about such basic human needs as where their next meal is coming from. Our first guest this weekend does not forget about the needy, especially this time of the year. He is Tom Cullimore. His organization is appropriately enough called HOPE, short for Help Other People Eat. Tom, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Kurt.
Let's talk about HOPE, H-O-P-E. How did it come into being? I mean, this is your baby.
It's my baby, and I just thought of something, and I thought, and I thought, and I thought, and finally I said, HOPE, Help Other People Eat. Mm-hmm. And it stuck, and it worked, and since I've started it in 05, it has gotten gigantic. Right now, as of today, I'm at 212,150 meals since I started.
You've got that number down. Well, let's tell folks exactly how it works. I mean, it's a pretty simple supply chain, but it's a very effective supply chain.
It is. I got all the best processors in mid-Michigan, and I work with them and the hunters, and I have signage in all these places about if you want to donate your deer to HOPE, it costs the hunter not one penny. He drops it off, tells them it's for HOPE. When stuff is done and finished, product ready to go, they call me and I go pay for it and then deliver it to a local food bank or one of the soup kitchens.
And these processors, and you've identified several of them, but they give you a special discounted rate when they process this deer meat, right?
They do. They absolutely do.
Now, for hunters who donate the meat, I mean, I know that hunters like their venison and what have you. I mean, what would motivate a hunter to donate a deer? Is it because they've got enough venison in the freezer already, or they just want to do something for humanity?
Well, both could be true, but I think most of it is they want to do something for humanity, or they have shot a deer, and now they're getting a second one, and they get the second one just for HOPE a lot of times.
Yeah. And so the hunters will, and you probably have hunters that do this on an annual basis, assuming they get lucky enough to bag a couple of deer, right?
I do, yes.
So you pick it up from the processor, and that's typically you or anybody, and some people that volunteer to help you, basically you. And then what happens to the meat? It goes
to many, 13 different food banks in the mid-Michigan area and soup kitchens. I mean, they're just all over. I take care of the outlying little food banks that nobody pays attention to and try to keep them fully stocked with meat.
Now, the meat is processed, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's ground and put into one-pound bags?
Yes.
And each one of those bags can serve about how many meals?
Well, you're going to get at least four. Mm-hmm. And in certain things like chili or something, you're going to get a lot more than four. But four is what I use per pound. That's how I come up with my amount of meals.
Yeah, if that, you translate that poundage into, typical ground beef or something, good quality ground beef, you're talking, $3 to $4 a pound. And with venison, which has some nutritional value that maybe beef doesn't have, you're even talking more.
Yes, you are. And when I first started this, I didn't know if the people would eat the venison. Mm. But now when I'm at food banks, all the people that run the food banks tell me if they're out of venison, the people are asking for it even when they have ground beef.
So how long does it take? I mean, particularly this time of the year, food banks are really looking for donations of food and cash as well, of course, but primarily food, because the number of people they're feeding this time of the year when the weather starts getting cold and over the holidays increases significantly.
It is, and it's just crazy. When I started this, Volunteers of America were feeding about 30 to 40,000 a year. Now they're up over 112,000, and also the mission is the same way. They are just desperate for food.
Yeah, and desperate for food. So, I mean, what a nice way to, because I would imagine that some deer meat, if a hunter's got an excess of venison already, I mean, there's only so much they can process. I mean, some of it might go to waste otherwise, and here's an opportunity for this meat to be put to a very good cause.
It is. I mean, I just can't emphasize that enough. It's just a fantastic thing, and it's grown beyond my beliefs.
Now, you've been very reticent about mentioning this, but I'm going to mention it. You have to pay these processors even though it's a reduced cost. That costs money. So you're always – tell us how folks can donate to the cause.
Okay. Well, I'm always hunting for donations, and they can donate to the cause by making a check out to HOPE. And then my name, Tom Cullimore, and my address is 6131 Lounsbury Road, Williamston, 48895.
You know, Tom, I'm going to put that, since you don't have a website, I'm going to put that up on an MLive blog to make sure that people have that address. And what we'll also do, we'll list, because you have a number of these processors that it would be good to recognize, and then all these different food banks. But give us that number again, the number of meals to date that HOPE has provided for these people who are – You said over 200,000, right?
Yes. Since I started in 05, I'm now up to 212,150 meals that I've provided mid-Michigan.
Well, that's wonderful. Tom, congratulations on the establishment of HOPE. It's a very seamless process. What a commitment on your part. And I think I need to mention, you're retired from Michigan State University, but you're not really retired at all. You're active in a number of things. But what a wonderful way to give back to the community.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Tom Cullimore. He's the founder of HOPE, which is short for Help Other People Eat. And look for our MLive blog to get more information on how to donate to the cause and also the processors and the food banks that are involved. Tom, great to see you again.
You too.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
MSU, we love thy shadows.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for alma mater.
So what that means is when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend, anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
And thy praises,
alumni.msu.edu.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. It was a fateful day in 1975 at the Student Union at Michigan State University when Jack Epps Jr., a graduate and award-winning student filmmaker, returned to his alma mater for coffee and chili with one of his former instructors, Jim Cash. Epps had made the trek to Hollywood after graduation and had begun to make some inroads, scripting episodes of such TV series as Kojak and Hawaii Five-0. But he wanted to move to the big screen. During the course of a 40-minute conversation, Epps and Cash mapped out the skeleton plots for 10 motion pictures, of which several would actually be produced. Although Cash chose to remain living in Michigan and the duo would rarely see each other face-to-face after that meeting, through telephone and computer modem, they became a commercially and financially successful writing team. The pair teamed up on such popular 80s films as Top Gun, Legal Eagles, and The Secret of My Success.
I was a student, obviously, here at Michigan State, undergraduate, and I had made some movies. And so I thought if I'm going to make movies, I should learn how to write them. So there was one screenwriting class, and I went to get into the class, and the class was filled. I couldn't get in, so I went and lobbied the professor to let me into the class, and that was Jim Cash, and he did let me into the class. And so I took the class, learned a little bit from Jim, and then we just stayed in touch. I liked his writing. He was a novelist at that time, and I was wanted to be in film, and so we just stayed in touch over a period of years, and eventually we decided to work together, and we worked long distance for 25-plus years. I was living in Los Angeles, and Jim continued to live in East Lansing.
How does the creative process work for you, Jack?
In general, creativity is something that I think you just sort of stuck with, and it's like either you discover this part of you or you don't, but you still have it your entire life, and you find different ways to do it. And for me, it was actually by taking classes here at the university, I wrote some short stories and things as part of a GE class, American Thought and Language. And I realized I really liked it, and it satisfied a lot of the creative things I wanted to be doing. I mean, I didn't know they're creative. It's just stuff I really like to do. And so, you know, being here, the university gave me lots of opportunities to continue to pursue my creativity and taking creative writing classes, becoming an English major, literature, and just pursued it. And together, you know, I found somebody, Jim Cash, who was a great partner and a great collaborator, and we just found ways to use our different creative talents and approach to meld them together to a really lovely partnership.
What's your advice for MSU students today who want to follow in your footsteps?
Well, my advice to anybody who has a feeling that they're creative and they want to pursue the creative arts in any area is to do it. Be passionate about it, and don't listen to all the naysayers, but to basically believe in yourself and realize, one, this is a great university. You have all the opportunities to pursue any creative arts here and to do it. Two, don't be stuck just in your area. Like, I thought it was writing, and it became filmmaking, and that sort of was not what I thought it was going to be, but what it became, and that's what the university gave me, the opportunity to try to make a film. It gave me classes to try different areas, because what you think you might want to do is not maybe what your best creative talent is. But I also think you have to be brave. You have to be willing to take risks. You have to be willing to give all for your art. It has to be all passionate and encompassing, because otherwise you won't succeed.
How did MSU impact you and who you've become and continue to become, Jack Epps Jr.?
Well, you know, what's great about Michigan State is it gives you an opportunity to explore. There's so much here to discover and to just learn about. When I came here, I was a pre-med student, and it was one 8 a.m. English class in a headwind that told me I was not cut out for medicine, because if I couldn't make it to that class at 8 a.m., I surely wasn't going to make it through med school. And so I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I was pretty lost. I spent a couple years here sort of roving around, and I did find creative writing, and I like that a lot, but I was still it still was not the total passion for me. And, you know, what this university does is give you opportunities, and I think the biggest mistake a student can make is stay locked in an area and stay fixed and not take care, not explore other things, even if they know what they want to do. Broadening your life and your horizons, and Michigan State gives you that opportunity to really see all of the world in one remarkable campus.
Are there points you hope to make when you talk with students?
No. When I talk to the kids, there's no point I really want them to take away. And the reason is because everybody gets something else. And so there's nothing specifically I want to say, you must do this. What I want to do is just talk as a creative person, realize that, look, if you're creative, I'm like you, we're together, and, you know, maybe you can learn something from my journey, and maybe you can't, but the most important thing is to believe in yourself. That's the hardest thing about being creative, is there's so much doubt we all have in our minds all the time. So how do you go off in a creative field in this world of doubt? That's difficult to do, and that takes faith in yourself and a willingness to take chances. And the truth is, the more chances you take, the more times you fall on your face, okay? Because that's the truth of all sort of, you know, entrepreneurial, creative sort of endeavors. But it's the people that get back up and keep doing it again and again that succeed, because they have that passion and long-term commitment.
Jack, are there myths or misunderstandings most of us have about Hollywood and how it operates?
Oh, probably. You know, I've been in Hollywood Hills, and I'm sitting by the pool reading scripts and calling, you know, get PG on the phone. It's actually a job. You know, being a writer and working in the movie industry is actually having a job. And I have a very sort of 9-to-5 blue-collar approach to my work, that it's not about being hit by inspiration. It's about perspiration. You know, 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. I think that was Edison who said that. And so that's the misconception, that they think everyone's just out there in la-la land, you know, all floating in the hot tub. I have a hot tub. It's broken, but I have a hot tub. You know, so, but it's really, you know, it is dedication. Any job you do, creative or any area, you have to be dedicated to it. And it has to be something that you enjoy, because there's nothing worse than doing a field that you don't want to be doing. And if that's where you are, then you need to look for something that's going to be fulfilling to you, whether it's creative or it's just a different area of your life.
What are your thoughts on passion in one's profession, Jack?
I mean, you do have to like what – you really have to be passionate about what you're doing. You have to have a feel for it. It's something that sort of find fulfilling in some way, shape, or form. And I think there's a real sort of – you know, society tells us we should consume and consume and consume and consume. And yet what we really want to do is do things that fulfill us. And sometimes you can't be a massive consumer when you're trying to get yourself started. So you have to realize what are most important in your life, which is you save your pennies and save your nickels and support yourself in something you love so that you can get that as your full-time job. And that's – people want it to – they want things now. And careers take time to build. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of dues. You have to pay dues right now. You know, there's a lot of internships that people have to do for long periods of time before they get hired. I don't like it, but that's the way things are, and therefore you have to be doing things you really enjoy.
Do you worry about today's young people being consumed with the new technology and social media?
I think it's a generational thing. I truly do. I think that this is who the world is, and this is who they are, and this is the life they're living. I mean, that's sort of like people saying, you know, boy, these horses are sure great. I really love my horse, and now with this iron horse, this car thing, it's not the same anymore. I don't get to put it to bed at night. And I think it really is generational. This is their world. This is the world we live in today. And it will evolve out of the way it's going to be. You know, there's always yin and yang. There's always extremes. And things will go many different directions. But, you know, we move at an incredibly fast clip. And I think it's sort of like, you know, either get on and get with it or watch it sail.
You love coming back to MSU, don't you?
You know, it's always great coming back to this campus. I mean, last night, the first thing I did was park the car, found a meter. Hard to find a parking space, I got to tell you. I found a meter and quickly grabbed it. So that's never changed, you know, parking on campus. But, you know, walking in the Commons area and Beaumont Tower and hearing the tower ring, I mean, you know, every alumni goes, you know, it just sends chills up your back. I don't have a student if I loved it as much, you know what I mean? You walk by and say, oh, there's that tower. But, you know, coming back here, it really is time traveling. It throws you back to, I mean, I start thinking about being a freshman. And, you know, college isn't all easy stuff. Everybody says, oh, you're college. You know, there's a lot of things that the people go through. It's a period of amazing growth and development. And you start as a baby, really. You start as like this very know-nothing from high school. And you come out really with a lot of experiences, a lot of maturity. Still a hell of a lot to go. The 20s aren't easier, you know. The 20s are like, wow, boy, it's a big ball you pushed up the rock. But, you know, I love this place. I love Michigan State because of what it has given me, the opportunity to find myself in this very, you know, it's a large university. I came from a very small high school. I had 32 in my graduating class, okay. So coming to this university, being a large, how large it was, at first was a very difficult transition. But once I realized how much was here, and how much opportunity I could take and how I could explore, you realize the size is such a benefit. And I think that's what's so special here. You know, so when I think of Michigan State, I think of it as a place that just gave me lots of opportunities to find and discover myself. And I think that's one of the biggest parts of college, is not only just what do you learn, how can you apply it, what job you can get, but who am I? And what do I want? And how can I actualize these things? And how can I be this person? And, of course, I found my wife here. We're still married. We have two kids. And that's a good thing. You know, that's that's a benefit.
That's Michigan State University College of Arts and Letters alumnus Jack Epps Jr., who, along with his partner and late MSU Professor Emeritus Jim Cash, were a successful Hollywood screenwriting team. For more on the college, please visit cal.msu.edu. I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at spartanpodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.